So welcome back to our mini-series entitled The Rescuer. We are now on the third installment of it, this mini-series. And if you miss any of the first two messages on the series, you can watch them or listen to them on YouTube or our Facebook channel, our Facebook page, or our podcast, and even our website. So you have all these options. So please take the time to listen or watch the messages there. Once again, this series is a prequel. Okay, if you've joined us the past couple of weeks, this is a prequel to our main sermon series, which will be on the book of Exodus. It's going to begin as soon as this series ends. And the goal of this series, the mini one that we're in right now, is to show us why and how the Israelites ended up in Egypt to begin with. And therefore, hopefully give us a bigger picture of or a complete picture of the story as the people of God prepare to depart Egypt near the beginning of the book of Exodus. So the book of Exodus is not just them leaving Egypt, it's them, you know, facing all these trials and, you know, tribulations as they wander around the desert after they left Egypt. Now, if you've been able to join us for the past 2 weeks, we have been focusing on the life of Joseph and the lessons that we can learn from his experience in becoming the chosen rescuer of God's people at this point in their history. So to see where the Israelites came from before they went into Egypt, we decided, or as a, you know, as a sermon series, to focus on the life of Joseph to show where the Israelites actually came from before they got to Egypt. And we began the story of Joseph in Genesis 37 a couple of weeks ago. Gave us a background of the sons of Jacob or the sons of Israel. But mostly, if you were to read it again, the focus was on Jacob's favorite son. Who was that? Joseph, right? We saw how and through the story of Joseph, we saw how the sin of the father, Jacob, ignited the jealousy of his other sons, which resulted in Joseph's being sold to the Ishmaelites and then to Potiphar, the Egyptian, as a slave. And then last week, we saw that even in the lowest point of Joseph's young life, okay, so again, Joseph was the prince of their household, and then all of a sudden, his brothers beat him up, threw him into a ditch, sold him to the Ishmaelites, and then the Ishmaelites sold him back to Pharaoh. So his life was up and down, and right now he's at his lowest point where he's now in Egypt serving this his master, okay? He's now a slave instead of a prince. We saw that God never abandoned him. So even in the lowest points, God was always there. He was always sovereign over the whole thing, that God had a purpose for his life, for the life of Joseph. And we see it, and we saw it, that as God, as he is, his new life in Egypt kind of transpired through the story here in Genesis, we saw that God was with him the whole time. And even when he was at his lowest, that God never abandoned him, but he continued to abide with Joseph and, you know, pretty much helped him to become the most successful slave in Potiphar's household. We saw that last week. And Joseph was so successful and found favor in the sight of Potiphar that Potiphar made Joseph the overseer of his house and put him in charge of all that he had in verse 4 of this chapter, right, 39. And because God had his hands, the blessing was on Joseph, God even blessed the house of Potiphar for Joseph's sake, right? We saw that again in verse 5. It also says in verse 5 that the blessing of the Lord was on all that Potiphar had in his house and in the field. So because of Joseph, or for the sake of Joseph, God blessed even the household of his master. So that's how far God was willing to abide with Joseph, right? In order to accomplish the purpose. Remember, Joseph is a mini rescuer, okay? He's a pointer to the great rescuer, which is Jesus Christ, and his life and his rescue of the Israelites at this point in time in their history is something that God ordained and God planned so that the main rescuer, the ultimate rescuer, Christ, would ultimately come. And he came through one of the sons of Israel, Judah, in that lineage. And so God had to preserve that lineage throughout the history of the Israelites. And one of the ways he did that was through the mini rescuer that we're studying right now, which is Joseph. So in God's abiding in Joseph for that very purpose, he even blessed the household of Potiphar. And Potiphar trusted Joseph to the point where verse 6a says he had no concern about anything but the food he ate. So he pretty much put Joseph at the same level as himself as far as authority in the household is concerned, that he had nothing else to worry about. Potiphar had nothing else to worry about but the food that he ate, verse 6a says. And then last week, what we were studying, that verse, we left Joseph at that high point. Okay, so from being sold twice, or not even that, from being beaten by his brothers and then sold twice as a slave, we see Joseph now at the highest point of his life, obviously, except for when he was at home with his father. He's now at the highest point of his life, in his new life in Egypt, right? That's where we left Joseph last week. So we saw that even though he was just a slave, he was the top slave, right? He was the top slave there in the house of Potiphar, the most successful slave in the household of Potiphar because of God's abiding presence. But, just like what we talked about last week, life is all about the ups and downs, right? And how we handle them. And Joseph's life is no different. So this next character that's about to be introduced to us here in the end of chapter 6 and all the way down to 20, is about to take Joseph to a different level of lows as far as his life in Egypt is concerned. So let's go. Let's start. Last part of chapter 6 verse 6 in chapter 39. Let's read it again all the way to verse 7. 6b. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And 7. After a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." If this was a Hollywood movie, you know, there'd be no story. You know what would happen. But it's not. It's the Bible. So let's see what happens here. So main thing I want us to notice here, and pretty much the gist of our message for today in this text, is that God's earthly blessings, okay, God's earthly blessings can and will be used by our enemy, Satan, in order to rob us of God's spiritual blessings, okay? God's earthly blessings can and will be used by our enemy in order to rob us of God's spiritual blessings. That's the main point that I want to get across to everybody here. Or everybody who's listening, all 71 connections, okay? Because note how our text says, okay? Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. If you look at the original Hebrew word used for handsome there, it was used twice, okay? If you were to read this in Hebrew, that word handsome was used twice and used in two forms, okay? The same Hebrew word, the Hebrew word yafe, okay, which means fair or beautiful, was used in that verse in two ways, to mention his outer appearance and to mention his inner character. So Joseph was not only handsome in appearance, we can also say that he was also beautiful inside as a person, right? And we can argue that these characteristics that Joseph had are both God-given. He was born with it, so to speak. As much as we can probably say that these characteristics are a reflection of his mother. It was Joseph's mother, Rachel. Because Rachel was also described in Genesis 29:17 as beautiful in form and appearance. I think that's why Jacob was so in love with Rachel, right? Rather than Leah. So when we talk about Joseph's appearance, obviously he looks handsome, but now he's not just handsome. Because there are some people who look nice on the outside who are so ugly inside. Yeah, we were watching this movie this weekend called Shallow Hal. I don't know if you guys saw that movie. But in Shallow Hal, there's this guy named Hal who pretty much is a vain guy. And all he saw and he judged people with was their outside appearance. If they were pretty on the outside, he liked them. But if they were ugly on the outside, then no, I don't pay attention to them. He doesn't see the beauty inside inside of people. So he judges them by their appearance. So one day he was hypnotized to only see the inner beauty of people. And from then on, he saw everybody who was ugly on the outside as beautiful because he doesn't see their appearance on the outside anymore. He only sees them for the beauty that they have inside. Imagine Joseph then. How would Shallow Hal see Joseph? He was beautiful outside and inside. So that's the thing here. That's what Joseph is being described as when it says that he was beautiful or handsome in form and appearance. Now, let's face it, okay? There's a saying that says beauty is in the eye of the beholder, okay? But as far as outer appearance is concerned, there are some people who are just more physically beautiful than others. And Joseph is one of those people. And not just beautiful on the outside, but also on the inside. And I can argue, and I hope you agree with me, that all these traits, all these characteristics that Joseph is being described having here are both gifts from God. Okay? He was born with it. It's a gift from God. But as we will see now, how does the enemy use this against Joseph? How does the enemy take God's gifts, physical, earthly gifts, and use it against Joseph? Check out, again, verse 7. After a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." Now, it says there that Potiphar's wife has had her eye on Joseph for some time. Okay. After a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." What that means is that Potiphar's wife has been working up to this moment, right, to ask Joseph to sleep with her. So it's not like, you know, it's the first time she saw Joseph and right away she was like, "Okay, come sleep with me." No, it wasn't like that. It's been some time that she's been, you know, watching Joseph, you know, looking at him and, you know, observing Joseph. And then she worked up to this point where she actually asked him to sleep with her. And when you look at that verse, what I can see from that verse and what we can learn from that verse is that that's how typically how our enemy works, right? The enemy knows that we are all prone to commit sin because of our sinful nature. We all have it. All human beings have this sinful nature. And because of this sinful nature, our God-given desires can and will be used against us by the enemy. How? By tempting us to refocus those desires that ought to be for the glory of God and for our joy in God, okay? To refocus those to something else, something that is not worth it, something that is cheap, something that is fake. So now those desires that are supposed to be for God and for our joy in God are refocused onto something else. That's what the enemy does when he tempts us. Again, and this is how the enemy leads us into sin. So temptation by itself, okay, and I'm going to say this again later, is not sin. But that's how the enemy leads us into sin. Check out James 1, 14 and 15. Says James 1:14 says, "But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire." Okay? lured and enticed by his own desire, then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. Okay? So it starts off with our desires that are increasingly refocused by temptation. And then once we jump into temptation or fall into temptation, it leads to sin. And ultimately, you keep going that way, it's going to lead to death, right? Or in other words, as human beings, we all have different desires. We all have different wants. It's all about, entertainment sometimes for me. I get bored easy. So the enemy knows that. And he uses all kinds of things that entertain, from Netflix to YouTube or sometimes video games or, you know, something that entertains to kind of lure me in to sinning, stealing away to rob me of my, the spiritual blessings that God has given me, to rob me of that, to refocus my desires onto something else. We all have our own thing, so to speak, when it comes to our desires. And again, all of these desires are God-given, okay? These desires are to be used for God, in order to find our joy in God, in order to glorify God. But like what I said earlier, the enemy takes those God-given desires and gifts and uses them in order to rob us of our joy that these desires and gifts ought to bring, namely joy in God. Now, I said this earlier, I'm going to say it again. Being tempted in and of itself is not sinful. Okay? You're not committing sin if you're being tempted. Okay? Giving in or falling into temptation is what gives birth to actual sin. Okay? Say that again. When you give in to the temptation, that's when you're actually sinning. Because what is sinning in biblical terms? Sinning is simply to miss the mark. So if our desires or our God-given desires or gifts are supposed to be focused on God as our target, and what temptation does is to refocus that onto something else, when you give in to that temptation, you miss the mark. You missed your target. That means you sinned. And that's only when you give in to the temptation itself. Now Jesus puts it on a different level when he says what? Don't even look at a woman. Looking at a woman is adultery. Jesus knows how dangerous temptations can be, especially sexual temptations. That's why he said, don't even look. Looking at a woman is adultery. But really, if you take that into context, and if you take sin into context, and temptation by itself, on its own, is not sinful. Giving into it is actual, leads to actual sin, or it becomes sin when you give into the temptation. I hope that's clear. I'm going to give you a picture, like an illustration, how I kind of picture temptation, okay? So the picture that comes to my mind when it comes to temptation is that temptation is like quicksand. Okay, if you know what quicksand is, good. If you don't, well, quicksand is this mixture of two phases of matter, the solid and liquid, that is packed together to produce a surface that looks like it's solid. Okay, that's what quicksand is. It looks like from the top, it looks like it's solid, but once you put weight on it, it collapses. That's why people sink into quicksand. Now, note, again, quicksand looks like it's solid, but in reality, it's not. That's how people get sucked into it, thinking, oh, I can step on this, I can step on it and be okay. Meanwhile, once you step on it, you're going to sink, right? Realizing this about temptation is very important, okay? Temptation is like quicksand in that it looks like the real thing, but really, once you step into it, it's not. Once you fall in it, you'll realize, oh man, this is not what I was expecting. Because temptation, that's what it does. It always promises to give us something. That's what temptation does. It's a promise to give you something. Whatever that something is, it could be fame, it could be fortune, it could be riches, it could be satisfaction. You name it. That's what temptation does. It promises to give you something. And from the looks of it, it looks like everything that it promises could actually come true. Like when you buy the lotto, when you're tempted to buy the lotto, we always use this as an illustration, right? At the moment of buying lotto, the moment of being tempted to buy lotto, okay, I don't know if this is just me or if this is reality for everybody. What are you thinking about, right? Are you thinking about losing? Obviously not, right? You're thinking about the promise that lotto has. That's why when you watch the commercials, it's all about, oh, you know, living the life and blah, blah, blah. I forget the slogan of 649, but that's what it is. It's a promise to give you something. And then when you check your numbers, promise not true. It was just your imagination. That's why thanks Jesse for the imagine the freedom. That's their lotto, right? That's all that you can do is imagine it, because for a lot of people it never comes true. No matter how many years you buy lotto, and that's what temptation is. It promises you something that it couldn't deliver. It only looks like it could, but in reality, when it comes to temptation, is that it never lives up to the hype of its promises. Its temptation's promises always comes short. Okay, but again, once you fall for it, once you're into it, it's hard to get out. It's like quicksand, right? So same thing, again, like quicksand, being around quicksand or even seeing quicksand won't kill you. Okay, but once you step in it, even though the quicksand itself won't kill you, the fact is that it's hard to get out of quicksand on your own means that other things will inevitably cause your death, right? So when you step into quicksand, there's not a lot of people drown in quicksand, okay? I know that when you watch the movies, oh, they go down in quicksand and it goes over their head. That's not true. Okay, when you study what quicksand is, usually the furthest you can go into quicksand is up to your waist, up to here. But you can't get out because every time you put pressure, it kind of packs in the sand around you, so that there's no moving. So if you get stuck on quicksand like on a beach and then the tide comes in, the quicksand didn't kill you, but the tide will. Do you understand what I'm saying? Quicksand by itself won't kill you. It's not the thing that ultimately causes your death. Things like dehydration, because if you get stuck in there for a long time and there's no water, you die. Things like suffocation, if you get stuck in there, if you lie down on quicksand, if you're stuck in there for hours or days and you get tired, you lie down on it, you suffocate, you die. If other predators get to you and you can't move in your quicksand, ultimately, they'll eat you. You'll die. And again, drowning. If you're in quicksand and that path where you get stuck in the quicksand is like a river, or it's reachable by the tide. When the tide comes in, you will drown, and that's what ultimately kills you. Temptation is the same thing. Okay, temptation by itself seems harmless, even if you fall into it. Right. But once you fall into it, and it's often hard to get out, temptation in and of itself will most likely not kill you, but the consequences of your actions because of the temptation more likely will, right? Not to mention that the sin that temptation ultimately brings to the one who falls for it will always lead to death if you keep going that way, if you keep falling for the same temptation over and over and over and over again. It's like drinking alcohol, right? Every time you drink alcohol, there's a temptation to drink more, right? Now, at that point, you're being tempted to drink more. It's harmless. What's another one? What's another one, right? But if you fall, into it, if you give in to that temptation, it could lead to drunkenness. Now, drunkenness, biblically, is a sin. But ultimately, for most people, drunkenness by itself won't kill you. But the effect of that will. Like alcoholism. If you're an alcoholic, ultimately that's going to kill you. Or if you drink and drive, maybe it won't kill you, but you end up killing somebody else. So I'm not saying that it's bad to drink, okay? I'll even go as far as to say that being tempted to drink too much is not bad in and of itself, but falling into the temptation could lead to the sin of drunkenness and even death through other means, like drinking and driving and alcoholism. Not to mention all the divorce that, we're talking about divorce in Sunday school, not to mention that. You know how many marriages have been broken up because of the sin of drunkenness? That's why we shouldn't take that lightly. Some people, I can control myself, I can do this, I can do that. You're being selfish at that point because you're not looking at other people who are looking at you, especially your kids, who can see you and say, oh, my dad says it's okay to drink, therefore I will too. What if your kid can control herself or himself? What's going to happen to them? So think about it, right? The Bible's not going to warn us of temptation if it's not dangerous, not just to our lives physically, but to our lives spiritually. So take this warning seriously. just drinking and driving is just one example of how the actual temptation by itself, although not sinful in a way, could lead to sinfulness and even death. So now, going back to our text, how did the enemy take God's earthly gifts and use it to potentially rob Joseph of God's spiritual gifts? Meaning, when I'm talking about spiritual gifts to Joseph, meaning his relationship with God. When we look at our text, we see two examples of two people being tempted, right? Joseph being tempted and Potiphar's wife being tempted as well, right? And again, Joseph is not the only one being tempted here. When you read this, Potiphar's wife is being tempted as well, right? Therefore, what we need to notice is what does it look like for somebody to fall into temptation? And on the other hand, what does it look like for somebody to fight against it, right? Because both of them are being tempted. So let's first look at Potiphar's wife. Potiphar's wife is being tempted by both Joseph's form and appearance, okay? When she sees Joseph, she's observing Joseph, she sees his, he's handsome in form and appearance. That's temptation to Potiphar's wife. And Potiphar's wife is being tempted by that. But not only that, I think Potiphar's wife is also being tempted because of her desire for sex. She has this desire for sex. Now, what does that mean? What does that second one mean? Now, most commentaries say that Potiphar, being a high-ranking officer of Pharaoh, is also a eunuch. Okay? We were talking about this in Sunday school. What is a eunuch? Okay? Eunuchs back in those days were not just the slaves, because some of the slaves in Egypt back in those days were made to be eunuchs, meaning they're castrated, their sexual organ is cut off. Now, not just them, but high-ranking officials and guards of the Pharaoh are also made to be eunuchs. They are also castrated in order to make them more reliable servants who are less prone to physical influence or temptation, right? So if you're in charge of, say, the king's wives, most likely you will be made into a eunuch. So you're not tempted to sleep with one of the king's wives. You're not tempted to be, intimate with one of the king's wives. And Potiphar, being a high-ranking servant, okay, a lot of theologians are saying, must have been a eunuch. And back in those days, eunuchs can still marry. Even though they don't have the, tools for sexual intimacy, they still married. Now, what does that mean to the wife? If you're Potiphar's wife and you lack sexual intimacy in the marriage, and you have a desire for it, what's going to end up is you're going to get it from somewhere else. And that's the temptation. Satan sees that in Potiphar's wife, and then he sees Joseph. Oh, there's a temptation. Because Potiphar's wife is lacking sexual intimacy in her marriage, must be one of the reasons why she was tempted to offer herself to Joseph because of her desire for sex, right? So here we can see that the enemy does not only use Joseph's physical gifts in order to tempt Potiphar's wife, but he's also using Potiphar's wife's desire for sex in order to tempt Joseph, right? The enemy is using both the gifts, physical gifts of Joseph, and the physical or this desire for sex that is a gift from God to Potiphar's wife. The enemy uses that in order for her to be tempted and to tempt Joseph at the same time, right? Because when you read this text, and when I say that there's this sexual desire that Potiphar's wife is having for Joseph, listen, don't take that to mean that having sexual desire is something evil. It is not. Okay, having sexual desire, it is not evil in and of itself. God gave some of us the desire for sex, okay? Only to be fulfilled within the bonds of marriage for the purposes of procreation and enjoyment for the husband and wife. Now, I say some because some people, just like what we were studying in Sunday school, have little to no desire for sex, okay? And are gifted with this thing called celibacy that God says, you should use this for the furtherance of the kingdom. Paul is like that, right? The Apostle Paul. He had no desire for, very little desire for sex, that instead of getting married and having to focus on his wife, on a wife and children, he just chose to follow Christ and use his life for the kingdom. And for some, just like what it says in our text earlier in Matthew, in the book of Matthew, I think verse 19, chapter 19. Some are gifted that way. Some are gifted celibates. Not gifted singles, but gifted celibates. They have very little desire for sex, but at the same time, they have great desire for the kingdom. So not because you're single and not because you're single and celibate doesn't mean you are going to use your life for God's kingdom. There are some singles out there they're just celibate, but they're not using their life for God's kingdom. They're just single and celibate. And I think the gift there when it comes to celibacy is having this other desire, okay, instead of for sex, having this other desire to serve and use your life for God's kingdom. Potiphar's wife didn't have that gift, okay? Potiphar's wife had this, you know, hunger, desire for sex that she wasn't getting in her marriage. That's why the enemy easily tempts her to use that desire and uses that desire against her to tempt Joseph to sleep with her. And again, when you look at this gift of sexual desire, God purposed it to be used within the bonds of marriage for procreation and for enjoyment of the husband and wife. But there's another thing that God uses the gift of sex for, and it is as a weapon against temptation. I don't know if you guys know that sex, when used or when enjoyed within the bonds of marriage, is a weapon against temptation. Check out 1 Corinthians 7, 1-5. Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. Okay? But because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman have her own husband. If you have the desire for sex. And that means if you have the desire for sex, the enemy is going to tempt you with sex, right? So Paul says the husband, okay, and again, God ordained sex to be enjoyed within the bonds of marriage. But look what Paul says. The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. 5, do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement for a limited time that you may devote yourselves to prayer. But then come together again. For what reason? So that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. God gave that gift of sex not only for procreation and enjoyment, but as a weapon for husband and wife not to succumb to or fall into temptation. Right? And again, go back to our text. Potiphar's wife wasn't getting any sex. Therefore, her self-control when it comes to the desires that she have is at an all-time low. Therefore, the enemy uses that desire that's supposed to be good within the bonds of marriage and uses it against Potiphar's wife to be tempted into tempting Joseph. And again, this is partly because Potiphar's wife was lacking sexual intimacy in her marriage. And as we can see, if you read the text, she fell in to the temptation. She gave in to the temptation and approached Joseph to be tempted, approach Joseph to tempt him as well. Okay? And again, here we see someone falling into the temptation, falling into the quicksand, so to speak. And if you read the rest of the story, she never got out. She kind of kept going as far as, falling into this temptation. She kind of kept going until she would get what she wanted, but she never did. But that's what it looks like to fall into temptation. Right? That's how the enemy works. The enemy knows our weaknesses and uses God's gifts in order to lead us into temptation and to sin. Potiphar's wife's weakness is that lack of sexual intimacy in their marriage. And the enemy took advantage of that, took advantage of her weakness, and even used Joseph's physical gifts in order to lead her to fall into temptation. That's why the Lord's Prayer contains this, right? When you look at the Lord's Prayer, lead us not into what? Temptation, but deliver us from evil. Because if you keep going, if you keep falling into temptation, it'll lead to sin, and that is evil in God's sight. So when we look at Potiphar's wife, that's a great example of what it looks like to fall into temptation, what it looks like to be put in that quicksand. It's hard to get out, so therefore, get away from it, right? Don't even put yourself in a position to be tempted. And you know your weaknesses. You know the times when temptation comes in. Usually, when you're alone, that's when it comes. You know when this is going to happen. You can kind of feel it. And when it does happen, don't stay there and say, I'm strong enough to handle this. I will overcome it. Just get away. Just run. You can't fight. Sometimes you can't fight against it. Sometimes we will fall. But the good news is that sometimes, even though we do fall into temptation, God's gracious enough and merciful enough to pull us out of that quicksand. although you will have to face consequences, but that's God's way of actually teaching us, disciplining us, not to do that again, showing us that whatever promise the temptation makes usually will not be fulfilled. It's usually all just hype. And hopefully, the more we realize that, and the more we repent to God and confess our sins, every time we fall into temptation, the more we learn that, you know what, there's no point. There's no point in falling for this, because it just doesn't lead to anything good. And again, main example that we have in our text, Potiphar's wife. And she kept going, as you can read, right? She didn't stop after, you know, realizing that she was being tempted. She never stopped. She never realized that she was being tempted. She just dived in head first into temptation. But on the other hand, right, remember I said earlier, it wasn't just Potiphar's wife being tempted here with Joseph's physical attraction and his inner beauty and all that stuff. Joseph was being tempted too. But look at how Joseph responds to temptation. What does it look like for somebody to fight against temptation? Joseph teaches us three things in order to fight and overcome temptation. But for that, you're going to have to come back next week because we're already at 45 minutes. So next week, we're going to take a look at how Joseph fought against the temptation of Potiphar's wife. And he will show us three things in this story that will help us overcome temptation. Now, I know in this context, it's sexual temptation, but we can also apply it to any other temptation that we might come across when it comes to our own daily lives and how we're always being tempted. So for that, again, come back next week as we see how Joseph deals with this temptation. Amen. Amen. Let's pray.
The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord lift his countenance upon you
and give you peace.
And give you peace.
And give you peace.
And give you peace.
The Lord
make his face to shine upon you
and be great.
And be gracious.
Gracious,
the Lord be gracious.